Are we live now?
I'm recording.
You're listening to Mumbrella Cast. Mumbrella
Cast.
Welcome to the Mumbrella Cast. I'm Tim Burrows.
And I'm Vivian Kelly.
And joining us to break down the week in media and marketing is our reporter, Brittany Rigby.
Hello.
And this week's guest, Dentsu Aegis Networks CEO, Henry Tager.
Hi, Tim.
Later, we'll be talking about the week's topics.
Calling bullshit on the pitch process.
Seven buys Prime.
Seven sells Pacific.
And what we learned at the seven upfronts. So it's all quite seven heavy this week. So let's start by introducing our guest, Henry Tager. A long time of this parish, Henry. I think for a little while we thought that we'd said goodbye to you when you went off to the US, and we thought that might be it for your adventures in the Australian media. But then you came back to us in what always seemed like a challenging job. So I remember a few weeks or maybe even a couple of months back, I was writing a piece about people in what I was characterizing as impossible jobs, and I was trying to decide whether to characterize you as one of those impossible jobs. And we chatted, and you persuaded me that no, it was not an impossible job, and I didn't include you in that list. Now, what was your argument? Why are you not in an impossible job?
Well, first and foremost, I think the role I'm in is 100% possibilities as opposed to an impossible task, and largely because of the people that I've been able to connect with in the Dentsu family, what those people represent in capabilities, how relevant those capabilities are today, and more importantly, you know, tomorrow and beyond for our clients. So the role is, you know, far from impossible in my view, and in the short period of time I've been there, I'm convinced every day that the possibilities that, you know, are in front of us are starting to become real, and so it's by far impossible.
So why do you think the industry perception was that you were coming into such a difficult transition?
Well, I can't speak on behalf of the entire industry, and anyone who tries to hears about it pretty quickly. But I think a lot of the perception of the group relates to client wins, client losses. In our case, there's been, you know, more losses in the past couple of years, and that's, you know, received a lot of attention. I think people think that if you lose clients, that becomes an impossible situation. But what you learn from loss is, you know, far greater than what you learn from wins. That's what my history suggests, and I think the group's definitely showing me and showing ourselves that that's the case. As for what the market's perception is, I think that's something that, you know, we're mindful of, but that's not what we focus on. We're sort of focusing on what we need to do for our clients, what we need to do as a team and to our people. And that's a much more longer term view and a lot more sustainable.
And Henry, the other thing that people said was that at some point, Dentsu will come back. You know, it is everything cyclical, and there's always a favourite agency to talk about. There's always a perception that one holding group might be in more trouble than the others. So a lot of people have started saying, you know, Henry's going to tear it down, rebuild it, and get it back on top. So what's your estimation of when Dentsu Aegis Network will be back on top?
Well, I'm not sure whether top is the intention. That's definitely not the current thinking. What we're doing at the moment is focusing on, you know, our existing clients that we see as opportunities, and that's been really exciting. It's not just the, you know, Henry's going to do it. If that was the case, I wouldn't be doing it. It's a real team effort, and that's the reality of our situation with some of the amazing people that have been with the group for many years. We've, you know, been lucky enough to bring some fantastic human beings into the organization. And in the short period of time, some of these guys have been with us. The impact they're making suggests that any estimation of how much time it's going to take to get us to where we feel really excited by it's getting shorter and shorter because I'm seeing collective momentum amongst everyone in the organization, from the senior people to the more junior people, people in all different parts of the group with different capabilities. And what's happening is we're becoming closer and working in a more integrated fashion, which is, I think, anyone who's trying to grow in the future, it's all about coming together, simplifying what we do, demystifying, you know, how and what role we play with our clients, how we engage and create, you know, better outcomes with partners, whether that be media organisations or the press or bodies like the MFA or the Comps Council. All those things are important. And there's many stakeholders in what we're doing. So we're ahead of where I thought we'd be.
And I guess at any given time, you've got different agencies which are travelling at different speeds. That's always the nature of it. Where do you think your key agencies all are? Maybe just talk us through sort of a few of the key organisations and where you see each one in their journey at the moment.
I think it's probably easier to speak to the segments within the group, and I think that's probably one of the biggest secrets of what Dentsu represents in Australia. I think historically, and for all the right reasons, there's been a view that Dentsu is very much a media-based business. The reality is that 40% of the group is media.
And that's a good point, because I guess historically people think of it as the Aegis connection and way back the Mitchells connection.
Well, that's right. And through acquisition, the acquisitions have created a lot of attention and in turn, you know, formed the perception of what the group is. But the media and media-related businesses are the areas that I've been sort of most focused on in the last 6 months. I'm really, really happy and excited about some of the changes we've made there. I can see the spirit that has started to create amongst those individual businesses, whether that's within Cara with Sue joining, within Visium with Ash Earnshaw taking on the CEO role, or more recently with Daniel Isaac joining as CEO of DentsuX. There is confidence starting to seep through and back into the business. And that's really exciting, and that's half of it.
And what about the creative side?
The creative side, BWM and With Collective are the two sort of creative businesses. But both really exciting businesses. Both have huge opportunities to grow or evolve in the next sort of 6 to 12 months. I've spent a lot of time with Paul, Jamie and Rob at BWM and their respective teams.
Paul Williams, Jamie McKay, Rob Belgiovanni.
And, you know, they are, they're the Rolling Stones of the industry. They keep reminding me of that, as opposed to the Beatles.
Yeah, they're probably a bit older though, aren't they?
No, just to defend, you know, their age, they're a little bit younger than the Rolling Stones, but they're an amazing group. They produce some amazing work for some of Australia's largest brands and continue to do so. Having their capabilities in the group and connecting those capabilities to other parts, we're seeing some really interesting sort of chemistry and output as a result of that. With Collective is a more recent acquisition. We see a lot of opportunity with how With Collective is operating and part of the Isobar ecosystem. And we've seen some really good synergy in that space.
And with the With Collective, obviously it sort of started life as BWM did back in the day as independent agencies that were acquired. Again, there's an industry perception that one of the things you inherited was a sort of situation where a number of acquisitions have been made. Founders were getting towards the end of earnout. There was a real risk of a lot of people moving on and some big final earnout bills as well. Was there something to untangle there when you got there?
Well, there's always untangling, not just in you know, one part of the business. It's the whole business is an untangle with a desire to retangle in a different way. You know, my view on you know, big checks at the end of earnout is always a good sign. If you're in a position where you're having to cut a check at the end of an earnout that is bigger than you expected, that's usually good news. If you've managed succession and talent management through the process and you've got good engagement with the founders through that process, it makes it easier to transition from in earnout to post earnout. You know, good signs of that are when founders stay on in the business. And I think in many of the acquisitions that the group has made in the last decade, there's been a number of founders who are still part of the organization, which sort of highlights sort of cultural fit and appropriateness for, you know, their roles moving forward. I think we'll see the same with the acquisitions that are still going through that earnout period. And there are a number of those. And more recently, a number of new acquisitions that we've brought in that are at the beginning of their earnout period, which is a nice balance. But I wouldn't call it a tangle. I think it's our industry is all about the various puzzles that within that live within the various holding groups or you know now some of the consulting firms. It's a puzzle.
So if that wasn't a big tangle, when you got the job and you sat down and you started, what was the biggest problem you think you faced? You know, you're looking at the network, you're looking at the structure, you're looking at the people that you've got. What was the thing that you felt like you had to fix first?
Well, the most obvious opportunity, as opposed to a fix, is bringing the group together. And if... And I say that because, you know, we talked about this last week at the MFAX, just the whole notion of simplicity and simplification and doing that with the backdrop of such complexity in the marketplace. You know, the recipe to simplicity is bringing people together so that we can understand, you know, what are we doing two times? How can we do it once? Where are we bringing two brands to the table that is making it hard to follow what we're trying to say? And that has already started. So I see that as the ongoing opportunity, and that we're doing a lot of work to remind people that logos aren't really what's critical here. It's more capability and how we bring those capabilities together to help our clients achieve what they need to achieve in their business. And, you know, we've talked about this internally at length. The only logos that really matter are the logos of our clients' brands. Our logos really need to take a back seat, and that's as much a cultural change for the organization, and I would put anyone in this sector, as it is an operational and sort of growth-based objective.
And I find myself looking back to your time at IPG Media Brands here in Australia, and you came up, you know, initially you were running an agency, and then you became the executive chairman of the group. And it felt like your philosophy at the time was about creating a far bigger sort of field of services that could be offered to clients that went beyond sort of traditional media. And suddenly it became a bigger group, more revenue streams. And it was a really interesting model. It feels like you're thinking about a different model this time around, though, for Dentsu. Is that a fair observation? And if so, what are the differences in how you're thinking about life now?
Well, what we were able to achieve at Media Brands was at a moment in time where new capabilities and new services were required to deal with these new forces in the marketplace.
And when you came to it, that was really initiative and UM was the...
That's right. It was, and you know, the first of those new services was search, you know, SEM back in those days. And slowly but surely...
So you launched Ensemble, was that the search offering?
No, the search offering was Reprise. But that we launched a brand to cover that service many years after we had built out the capability. So we you know, at the time, because the marketplace still sort of needed comfort around... are you a specialist search firm? We needed to put a wrapper around it, and Reprise was the wrapper. And that was also an extension of a search organization that our US entity acquired. So we rolled that brand out, and we're seeing that in the market. Today, a lot of that diversification and expansion of services has already happened across most of the groups. and even some of the consulting firms. So it's the proposition now, the opportunity now as it relates to Dentsu is really about bringing those together in a seamless, frictionless manner around a client, really surrounding the client and just being sort of holistic to the client's needs. And that's a small but really important change in orientation.
So we alluded there to your role at IPG Media Brands, which was a really big global role. Now, I do note that every time we use a negative word such as issue, you then say fix and we say problem and you say opportunity, but I'm going to word the question this way anyway and see what you do with it. You had a huge global role at IPG Media Brands. Why didn't it work out?
Well, I had a great 2.5 years. There were a number of reasons why we came home, and it was partly family based, with our kids being at the point where we wanted them to start and finish high school in Australia, as opposed to get to a point where, especially our eldest Olivia, was getting to the point where she was in the years in high school where staying in the US would mean, you know, a longer term sort of thought process. The role I went in to do in the US running Media Brands globally was an amazing role. I loved every minute of it, and even when it came to an end, I was really, really satisfied and excited by what we had been able to do in terms of pivoting the organization. And I think the reason why I'm positive about it is I look at what they have been able to achieve since then, and it's been really positive. So I think it's easy and convenient for anonymous others in the marketplace to use change as a negative. Change is a positive. Whether that's joining a new role or leaving a new role, change is a positive, and that's how I'm hardwired. It did work out. It created a huge opportunity for me. It gave me an exposure to what is going on around the world, and particularly how the US market works, which is the navigating market for our sector. You know, we shouldn't lose sight of that. But it gave me really good insight into what good looks like, what bad looks like, and that's of huge value to me.
And what does bad look like?
What bad looks like is people not working together. No matter how good an individual is or an individual organization is, if they can't work harmoniously with others, and there's very few organizations in our industry that have a solo position and there's no one else. So if you can't work well with others, and if you can't assimilate to the most important party in that relationship, which is the client's need and hopes out of their investment, you're gone.
I remember interviewing you or moderating a panel that you were very kindly one of the speakers on in New York during your time in that role, when we did a sort of a session on Australians making it big around the world at Advertising Week. And I remember one of the things that you talked about then was, these are roughly the words because I can't remember it specifically, but I very much got the impression that one of the kind of cultural differences you'd experienced was the directness of Australians in business versus the way that perhaps, you know, sort of American business culture is. There was a real learning curve for you in actually you wouldn't always expect that speaking your mind would have quite the impact that it might have in another market where you were just giving an honest view.
Yeah. Well, you know, there are some markets around the world, and the US is one of those, where the perception you create is almost more important than the reality, and that applies in some cases. I think what that really sort of highlighted to me was having grown up in a market like Australia that is, in my view, one of the leading markets in terms of what we create, the output, the thinking, and how progressed we are. But challenged by scale, which creates the need for to be resourceful and to be, you know, really sort of entrepreneurial in spirit, sort of, and Australian culture and who we are as people, sort of forces us to get to the point, because we don't have time to meander around and sort of play the perception game, because there's just, we don't have that luxury. You know, that there were some situations that, you know, looking back at that, I think, wow, that there were people who must have thought, wow, this guy's really like out there telling us what he really thinks. But in equal measure, there were many, many times where that resonated and, you know, cut through and allowed us to move a lot faster. And we were able to pivot as an organization, really effectively. And I'm proud of that.
So after you left IPG, you had a couple of years of gardening leave.
Yep.
What did that period teach you? What did you get up to? How did time away from the industry shape how you think about the industry?
Well, having a couple of years off, I highly recommend that to anyone who can do that. I think it's good for the soul. And it's really important, because it does provide you some time to work out what the lessons are. I've always been someone who has assessed myself as I'm good at managing my time, and I think I still am. I think I'm usually on time and not late, or I try to get as much out of my day.
I would say at least 4 minutes early today.
I was a little early. Having time away, or time out, made me understand and shed light on something that I had never ever thought about, and that was, what is the value of my time? So being good at managing your time is good. I think it's an important skill set to have in any profession or as a human, because it's, time is not in our control. But if you can, you know, gauge the value of your time, then it helps determine where you put your time. And that's probably the most important lesson I was able to get out of that time. And I'm applying that now that I'm working again, not just in a professional sense, but more importantly in a personal sense with my family and my kids. And that's really, that's the only thing that matters. So, that's the most important lesson. The other lesson is, whilst you may, you know, people may think that, you know, if you've got time out or in the garden, you've got plenty of time, the day goes pretty quick. You know, I was up early, hit the gym, take the kids to school, have some lunch. Before you know it, shit, we've got to go get the kids. And then it's the whole evening routine. And by that stage, I was so tired. So I was busy. I got busy.
Next, the wash up from the Media Federation conference. So last week, the Media Federation of Australia held its inaugural MFAX conference. Media agencies closed for the day to let staff attend. Now, one of the sessions at MFAX was a panel called Killer Questions, in which agency bosses answered questions from the audience on topics like pitching, pricing, diversity. Henry, you were on that panel. I think one of the kind of interesting things was all of the panelists came from slightly sort of, I guess different brand positions. One of the oak unspoken things on the panel, which actually became spoken, not sure all of the audience heard it until they watched it back on the video, was publicists were represented on the panel. They'd recently won Kellogg's, which is a sort of matter of kind of public discussion in the industry that a number of different agency groups had declined to pitch on because of the terms around pricing. Now, Toby Barber made the argument that from publicists, he sort of, without referring specific to that client, talked about the sort of the global side of things, the fact that sometimes effectively, hey, you're stuck with agreeing a local price because of what the international deal was. And I think the first word you said in response was bullshit. What was the context of that?
Well, you know, first and foremost, you know, that comment and that panel has received a lot more attention than I thought it would. To be honest, I went to that panel with a view to be completely honest about whatever questions were provided, because I didn't have the questions. The questions were not provided. When we got started on that subject, you know, unfortunately, we weren't able to finish that conversation. And, you know, where I was heading on that conversation was trying to defend Kellogg's locally, because we were involved in that process, and I felt it was a really good process. There was a lot of negative headlines that were sort of directed to Tamara, who I thought was a really, you know, impressive CMO, and she was very collaborative, very inclusive. And what it highlighted to us, the way they managed their process, which was a good process, was to be open to discussion and open to looking at things in different ways to try and help those who would participate be able to participate. And we ended up deciding to participate because we were able to have an open and truthful conversation about some of the challenges that related to that. And I won't get into that. So, you know, the point I made that was, I think, more pertinent was the issue around pitching is not so much what certain agencies or holding groups are prepared to do in terms of what they're prepared to price their own services for. That is subject to whatever a CEO or a holding group wants to do. And that's a marketplace. But when you start to price someone else's product, and in the case, as it is in many occasions with media pitches, you start to price another channel, whether it's television, outdoor, digital, then you're taking the responsibility of setting a value on someone else's product, oftentimes without any consideration for that organization's willingness to accept that. And that was the comment around, you know, Toby's truthfulness was centered around that. And I think it's been sort of twisted to be something else. I, you know, for the record, I actually think the Kellogg's guys managed a good pitch, and they were open and they were very constructive and open and flexible commercially. I don't think that is what determined the outcome of that process. And I had the benefit of having a really positive conversation with Tamara afterwards, and that's the truth.
I think, though, IPG and Omnicom both, when they found out the payment terms, chose to walk away. And I know at one point during that panel, you not for this specific reason, but you did express admiration for Omnicom's journey when it comes to this sort of conversation. What made you point to Omnicom in particular there? What is it you think they've got right?
My comment towards Omnicom wasn't because I think they are, you know, they have a stance on commercial terms. I think every holding company has a portfolio of clients that represent different commercial arrangements, and they balance out to be whatever the ultimate annual output is. I think what the guys at Omnicom have done is show the marketplace what consistency looks like, and it looks good. I'm not that insecure to give a competitor some praise. I think they're a great operation. I want to go up against the guys from Omnicom, and I want to beat those guys when the time is right, for the right opportunity, around the right client, and that will give us a good sense of our own benchmarking and our own quality parameters. And Omnicom aren't the only. I think, you know, IPG is a really good operation. There are some really good parts of the WPP offering, as is the case with Publicis. So, you know, I'm not anti-competitors. I never have been, but I'm a competitor. And to compete, I think you have to respect your competition. And that was really the call out. It wasn't centered around whether they're better at saying no to clients on commercial terms, because I'm sure they've got some curly ones in their portfolio. Everyone does.
Brittany, back in June on stage at Mumbrella 360, Matt Baxter, who's the global CEO of Initiative, somewhat called for a bit of a ditch the pitch. For everyone listening, can you remind them what his stance on that was?
June seems like forever ago. So Matt's presentation basically hinged around a bunch of research that his team had done with Initiative data and RECMA data that said, this is why pitching's gotten worse. This is why pitching's gotten more expensive. This is why the scope of it's blown out. We need to say no. Essentially, he made a parallel between how agencies pitch and the process for choosing an agency versus the process for appointing a law firm or an architecture firm, and said that it's more and more unfair for agencies, and clients kind of need to step up and make the playing field fairer, which did include sort of this ultimate, should we ditch the pitch? Should we have this kind of glass door for pitches almost that he did say that he would set up if IPG allowed him to? We haven't heard anything further about that for a while. But yeah, that was Matt's position.
So Henry, do you agree with Matt's position there?
No, I don't actually, because I think I've always felt this way. I actually think the pitch represents the equivalent to the opening night on Broadway for the theatre industry. A pitch is really important culturally for agencies because it's a congregation point, and it brings all different parts of the business together under what is in many cases a really pressure cooker situation. And in most cases, it brings the best out of agencies, at least great agencies. There is some magic that happens through a pitch. Pitches are not my strength in terms of the role I play within an organization. But you know, I'm often amazed at how at the beginning of the process, you know, there's a pitch in place, there's a brief, and there isn't an answer, and through that process, whether it's a difficult one or an easy and smooth one, on game day, there is this buzz and there is excitement and everyone is up. And in many cases, the agencies turn up and show their best. What I think is more important than ditching the pitch, which, you know, I've known Matt for a long time. I love Matt. He's an amazing human being.
You brought him with you to New York, for instance.
He was in one of my bags in New York. He was in excess baggage. I'm just kidding. He's a good guy. He's a brilliant mind, and I think he's someone that Australia should be extremely proud of in terms of what he is achieving and what he has achieved. So, first and foremost, I think that's important to point out. What's more important, and I learnt this from Matt, is what you do in a pitch should be what you do every day, not Sunday best. And I think that is a more important insight that I think the marketplace needs to really be looking for through the process of the pitch, as opposed to look at what we can do and look at how cheap it's going to be, because that's not the reality once a decision is made. And in some cases, the process that you know agencies are put through doesn't result that way. But there are a number of companies and pitch consulting firms that do focus on that, and the clients that go that way end up with the right agency.
Does the industry have the resources to be pitch level energy every day, though?
Yes, if you think about. You know, a pitch is a production, but what we as an industry create, produce, and output on a daily, hourly basis is much greater than what happens at a pitch level, and I think that's oftentimes lost on the market because no one talks about, hey, at Clemenger today, 16 TVCs were cut, 4 radio ads were written, 16 out. That doesn't happen. That's not regarded as interesting enough, but that's the bulk and the grunt in the industry.
Well, just before we get off the topic of MFAX, what else did you get out of the day? What other discussions particularly caught your attention or made you think about afterwards maybe in a different way?
Listen, I thought James Warburton's points of views on the marketplace, you know, their role in the market, how agencies position themselves was.
James Wharton, CEO of Seven West Media.
That's right. I thought that was sort of really pointed, really fair, and a call out. I was really impressed with some of the younger people in the industry getting up in front of, you know, 1,500 people and, you know, expressing either their views or their experiences. That I know when I was at that point in my career, you know, that I probably wouldn't have done that. I wouldn't have had the confidence to do that. And I'm really encouraged by just the caliber of the next generation. The next generation's caliber is of great, great excitement to me, and they're far more superior to my generation of executives in the marketplace. And so there were some call outs. Just seeing how many people were there for the whole day said to me, we've got an industry of believers, but what's the faith? And you know, I tried to make, maybe it was a bit too late in the piece. I think the bullshit comment may have stolen the limelight. But the real point that the reason why I really went to the panel was because I actually wanted to say, who's reminding our clients and ourselves that marketing grows business? So talking the marketing sector up, being positive about that, is something that since I've been back at Dentsu, all I'm hearing is what's declined, who's in trouble, who's losing. What we're not hearing is the success stories, which there are far more than failures. And I think we as an industry, including Mumbrella and the other trade publications and platforms, I think we have a responsibility to make time and create content that represents and highlights the importance of our industry. Otherwise, we've got bigger issues. And I don't think we're talking enough about that.
Next, let's talk about Seven.
Seven held its upfronts event this week to reveal what 2020 at the network will look like. The theme was One Place, to show media buyers that they can reach 90% of Australians through one network. But the one place we really heard about was Tokyo. We did have a bet amongst the team about how many times the word Olympics would be used. Now, Tim, I think you bet 24 and I tallied
24,
and
yes.
I tallied 25, but I think I did tune out a couple of times so that my tally might not be 100%
correct. What was your bet?
Oh, I didn't guess. I was the bookmaker. I was just...
I seem to remember Hannah guessed 48, didn't
yes.
she?
Yes. Well, look, I actually thought they'd say content-led growth more than they did. They did mention that a couple of times, though. Throughout the evening, we heard that much of the speculation we'd already been given was true. Big Brother's coming back. Farmer Wants a Wife is coming back. Former MasterChef judges Gary Megan and Matt Preston will be joining the network once they're off gardening leave. And we're also going to have a mini golf competition that sort of looks like Wipeout meets Australian Ninja Warrior meets Putt-Putt Golf in mega mini golf.
But didn't it look good?
Do you know what? I said to James Warburton afterwards, like when I first read that in a press release, it's hard to get a sense of a program from a press release. I looked at it and I was like, are you kidding? This is going to be terrible. I said to James, I was so wrong. It looked so good. And I reckon I'm going to watch it, which is a bit sad. Do you reckon you'll watch mega mini golf, Henry?
I think there were two standouts for men and mini golf was one of those. It's... I would describe that as it's a part Ninja Warrior, part Love Island, part Bachelorette, all set on the scene of a sort of Alice in Wonderland golf course
with a hint mini of golf and with a hint of kind of tongue in cheek irony as yeah, well. I think yeah. and if they get the right commentary team,
and I'm sure they will. So you know, I think I will watch it. I'll trial it.
And what Definitely. Was the other highlight for you?
I think the sleeper in terms of the new shows was Pooch Perfect. You know, what I think Seven have done, and I think they could attest to this more, but, you know, I know that they've put that in at the format sales at MIPCOM and have had great success with that format internationally. Prior to it, it's not even been shot yet and gone to air. So,
and this local version is Rebel Wilson.
And you know, with Rebel Wilson, who is a, you know, great talent, you know, a great, you know, front for the show. What it really talks to is, you know, a cultural blind spot that television has sort of forgotten about, and that is pets and the relationship with the furry member of the family. And I think proof to what I think will be a success is all the other family-related or family relationship-type shows, Married at First Sight, Love Island, Bachelorette, have been sort of standouts. They've really popped. Pets are, I think, going to be as prolific, and I think we're going to see some great success there.
And, Brittany, did you notice that before we threw to Rebel Wilson on a video, Samantha Armitage, the Sunrise host, came out on stage with some real life dogs, and my goodness, they seemed to have trouble standing up on that slippery stage almost.
I think that was one of my favorite moments of the whole thing though. It was great. Love a dog, love two dogs, love Samantha Armitage trying to keep two dogs under control. One of them was like jumping up on her very expensive and nice looking skirt. So yeah, I loved it. I thought
it was a nice skirt, wasn't it?
It was
quite unique.
It was.
I was sort of quietly hoping that one of the dogs would take a sort of bathroom moment, and I thought that would have been the highlight of the night for all the right reasons.
Well, the weird thing is, this is quite weird. I was having exactly the same thoughts.
It did. I think everybody was.
It seemed like Maximum Comedy, didn't it? Yeah.
I think that what Seven did really well was tell a good story from the opening, where they had the old footage play and sort of some actors dressed like they were from, you know, years gone by, looking up at the screen and sort of re-evoking what Olympics magic is and what it was to Kerry Stokes, through to, you know, using their talent really cleverly, I think, to link to the shows. I thought that it was, yeah, a really good decision by them, and it didn't feel overdone or overcooked.
I did say to James Warburton, the CEO of Seven, afterwards that they're in quite a good position to be doing upfronts at the moment, because the narrative around Seven has been about struggle, has been about failed programming launches. So it was good to see what has been Australia's number one network for so long actually be forced into having a bit of humility, which gave them such an opportunity to talk about how they could turn things around and make it better. You know, it wasn't just them beating their chests and saying we're number one. It was quite like, okay, well, here's where we failed. And I thought that was a really honest opening from James Warburton. He was really quite scathing of the network's performance, but in an optimistic way, like, here's where we've let you down, but come with us on that journey. How did you feel about James's opening, Henry?
Listen, I think James did a great job. You know, I spoke to James and to Kurt this morning and congratulated both of them on, you know, really sort of turning up yesterday evening. There's, you know, to your point around, you know, a little bit of humility and, you know, that really resonated and engaged with the audience.
Well, let me read out the quote. Weak, inward focused, tired and stagnant, with a string of poor programs and failures. Those were his own words.
Well, they're in James's view, facts of the past. But I think the way, the tone and the way that he addressed those was in a humble way, and I think humble is actually pretty engaging as a method, and the media industry has not been humble historically.
But I think that's why it was so different to see somebody at such a sort of chest beating event to actually be quite humble like that.
Well, I would put to you that when you are humbled as an organisation, you learn humble, and I think that's important. What we saw from Seven last night is that they have learnt some lessons from some of these programs that may have not have achieved what they want, the way in which they've positioned themselves. So I give those guys credit.
And what do you think, though, because clearly what what he had to do by doing that was there was an implicit criticism of his predecessor, Tim Warner, you know, because obviously everyone in the room knew that happened on Tim Warner's watch. If I were to advise you to critique Simon Ryan, your predecessor at Dentsu, what would your reply be?
Well, listen, I've known Simon for a long time. You know, we worked together over 20 years ago. To be honest, I don't think I've earned the right to criticise Simon just yet. You know, I'm still new in the organisation. You know, there are a lot of things that Simon...
James has only been there a month.
Yeah, but everyone's different. You know, while Simon was at Dentsu, in his various roles, I think there's a number of things that he did that were really good, and I've inherited some of those. There are some things that, you know, maybe unfairly Simon may be being perceived as the author of or the creator of, and that will always come when there's a change of guard or what have you. But, you know, it's not my place and it's not my style to, I don't really talk about the past. You know, the only thing that matters to me is the future and what we're doing today.
Speaking of the future, one of the things I did say in reading through these programming announcements was we're heading into 2020. Reading the programming announcements on paper, it did feel a little bit like going back to 2002 in that it's Big Brother, it's Farmer Wants a Wife. You know, apparently Big Brother's already had more than 30,000 applications, which is huge. But do you think that we're sort of relying on nostalgic programming rather than innovative programming? Because it did feel like a lot of the formats they're bringing back we have done before when I was at high school.
That's one way to look at it. I'm forever the optimist, or maybe I'm the contrarian, I don't know. But some of those programs that you reference were programs that were hugely innovative. I remember when Network 10 bought Big Brother out, it was up at the Gold Coast. No one had seen anything like it. What it meant in terms of television experience and voyeurism was like off the Richter scale. Bringing some of those formats back, it's easy to say same format, different time, but the most fundamentally changed part of that combination is not the actual format, but it's the broadcast platform that they're going on. So when Big Brother was first launched, it was on a linear platform. It was a one channel. 10 was only 10. Big Brother on 7 will be potentially on 7 or one of their channels, plus BVOD, every screen available, social, et cetera, et cetera. So there are many more dimensions that we've not seen yet that could actually be the leading dimensions. Linear may not, and I would expect linear will not be the leading driver of Big Brother audience. And that's, I think, the insight here is, let's forget about this as TV. What does this represent or create as an audience opportunity? And how do brands maneuver or navigate around audience opportunities for their brands and how they engage with us, whether that be through social only or holistically or through linear or any part of that?
Well, Britt, while we're still talking about sort of the content side of things, I was sitting next to you, and then I think it was Vivian and Hannah, so you could see them more closely than me. When we got on to Farmer Wants a Wife, I thought, because it was a very well-cut trailer, I thought they were actually getting a bit tearful. Now,
Vivian was not getting tearful.
Have been that Vivian was just upset because she'd left her phone in the office and she was finding that stressful, but particularly Hannah. Your take? Was I reading
this?
That
is
right?
So unfair to Hannah, who's not in the room.
Poor Hannah out at her desk having no idea what I'm about to say.
And also, what did you think of Farmer Wants a Wife?
Well, I think Hannah is a huge fan. I think she wouldn't mind me admitting that she's probably Farmer Wants a Wife's number one fan. We were worried, and the reason why the three of us were chatting is because when it came up on screen, the various Facebook comments, we were like, wow, what if Hannah's comments are among those? Because Hannah had tagged us on Facebook, I think, saying that she was about to break up with her boyfriend because applications were open. So that's what we were laughing at. But
she did get teary when one of the farmers sort of said that he was struggling and really just needed some help. There were definite almost tears.
Yeah, look, I never watched Farmer Wants a Wife. I was never hugely into it. I'll be interested to see how, I guess, the more wholesome proposition competes against, you know, maths next year, which has sort of been promoted as being more controversial perhaps even than this season was. So I think there's something to say about nice love stories and farmers, and they hinged it on kind of the drought, and it's more important than ever to have sort of stories coming out of regional, you know, Australia. So yeah, I think it'll be interesting. And I think it also connects with what you were saying, Henry, about Big Brother, which is, again, I never watched it. I think I was too young in Big Brother's heyday.
That makes me feel quite old.
But I think it's not like the new reality formats where they're having to build it from scratch and show people that it's worth it. They said a few times that it's, you know, the biggest reality format in the world, which it'll be interesting to see if that's still the case, say, this time next year. But there's already a huge audience there who will be super interested in what they do with it, who will tune in just to see if they feel the same way about it as they did 10 years ago. So I think it will, the audience numbers for both of those shows, I think, will be interesting just because they've got the fan base already there.
Well, Henry, just while we were talking about the trailers, one of the things that I guess one of the elements of all of the upfronts is they're this mixture of sizzle and substance. You know, it's not just telling people about next year, it's how you present it as well. It really struck me that Seven did such a good job just with how the trailers were cut. Do you, it's a bit unfair to ask you to pick a favourite of the three, but I'm going to. Who do you think just did the sizzle best this year out of 10, 9 and 7?
That's a multi-million dollar question, especially at this time of the year. I think the 7 and 9 presentations were of a different type, and because they have you know, a slate that are probably more similar, largely because they've got, you know, platform sport built into that. I thought Nine's up front last week, to be honest, I was really impressed with Nine. I thought the way in which they presented their content and the strength behind that really resonated with me. Interestingly, some of the comments I heard back from Nine was not a lot of new stuff. And I took that as a sign of strength. If you're not putting a lot of new programs on and relying on, you know, still viable formats, which I think Nine is very much in that place, that's a strong point. And Nine didn't have an Olympic sort of jewel to shine. I thought Seven, what we got yesterday was a humble version of what Seven used to do. When you know, back in the Leckie days and every brick in the wall, you know, it was a little bit more chest beating, but it was solid, and it was like, holy shit, you know, this is about as close to an upfront show that I've seen in Australia that resembles what I got to experience in the US. 10, to be honest, 10 maybe didn't have as much of the sizzle, but I found 10 quite authentic, and I think that's important as well. And I think to 10's credit, to Paul and the team there, you know, they've had other challenges at a corporate level with ownership and with sports rights lapsing. So the networks are in a different position, but you know, it's hard to go past networks that have got cultural sporting platforms in Seven and Nine, which they do with
in the cricket and the tennis.
Cricket, tennis, AFL, NRL, very hard to go past. I think that's a market view. The Olympics is a power play. Having the Olympics exclusively on every screen format is, you know, double down on power. You know, I've been saying this to a few people. Next year is not only an Olympic year, it's a leap year. And, you know, what am I telling people to do in a leap year? Take the leap and leap into the year, you know, back the television as a platform, as opposed to a channel. And I think great things will be returned as part of that.
So Vivian, we're already running a bit long. Lots else going on with Seven this week as well.
Yes. So Seven has sold its Pacific Magazines arm to its rival Bauer Media for $40 million with the Pacific team set to move in to Bauer's Park Street offices. And the CEO, Brendan Hill, has said there are no plans to cut any magazine titles.
Now, I wonder, do you think that's likely? I do remember reading an article on news.com.au quoting a certain media pundit who seemed to be predicting mergers aplenty.
Yes, I did give an interview to Shannon Malloy at news.com.au.
Ooh, calling out the journalist. How did you feel you were reported?
It's always interesting to be on the other side and to be asked questions and to see how other people would conduct interviews. I think that the gist of what I said came across, perhaps not exactly what I said. So I do have some sympathy for people who find themselves in the press because I read it and I was like, oh, you got the gist of what I said and you included my joke about Jennifer Aniston, which perhaps wasn't the most highbrow thing that I said. I would have included the Jennifer Aniston gag as well, so that's fine. But I don't know that I was quoted 100% correctly.
Remind us of the Jennifer Aniston gag.
Well, this all comes back to whether or not Brendan Hill, the CEO of Bauer Media, will cut magazines. My point to Shannon at news.com.au was that there's a lot of overlap between these rivals. They're fierce competitors. So, of course, when you bring them together, there's a lot of properties that traditionally have been fighting for consumer eyeballs. You're going to have a lot of celebrity titles in the form of NW, New Idea, OK, Who, and all of those. To me, when they're competing for advertising dollars, for consumer eyeballs, for that picking it up at the Woolies checkout when you're waiting for the self-serve to actually work, you don't want to be splitting that pie too much. There's only so many ways you can say Jennifer Aniston is pregnant. That was the basis of the joke. We probably need a few less Jennifer Aniston is pregnant stories. And I believe that they will have to consolidate some of those titles. I don't think that's a bad business decision. You don't bring businesses together to keep things the same at a time when the magazine market is changing so much. I think they can find synergies and efficiencies and probably consolidate the best of the titles that they have. I'm not calling Brendan Hill a liar by any means. I'm sure he wants to get the lay of the land and doesn't have immediate plans to cut everything, but I can't see all of those titles existing forever.
Henry, what do you think the advertisers want?
I think the advertising industry wants a healthy magazine industry. And the Pacific sale to Bauer, I think, promotes a healthier future. Less is more, whether that's less publishers or less magazines. I think it applies to both. So whilst selling Pacific out of the Seven West stable helps James and the team there bring down debt and you know commit to that 30% additional in investment in tentpole content. I think that's a good thing. Having Pacific and Bauer come together is a good thing for magazines. It will make it easier for the market to engage. It may result in less magazines, but I think we should sort of give credit to the Bauer guys. They know how to operate magazine businesses, and I think we'll see a stronger and more vibrant magazine sector as a result of that. So I think it makes sense. I think the market will engage. It'll be easier for Bauer to start promoting magazines without having to worry about competitive tension. I think it's healthier.
And also this week, Tim, just before we wrap up, Seven has announced its plans to purchase regional broadcaster Prime.
It's a merger.
Merger.
It's not a purchase.
A bit like Nine merged with Fairfax. Yeah. Was a merger.
Yeah, but it's a merger technically.
Technically, yeah. So we do have this debate quite often in the newsroom where sometimes we'll say merger and then sometimes we'll say acquisition, and it can be a funny dynamic, particularly with something like Prime and Seven, where they're doing the deal is. So you say merger.
Well, it's a merger of unequals, but it's a merger. And that's what's been proposed to shareholders.
And so, Tim, what do you think this means for Seven? On stage at the Seven Upfronts, James Warburton was very much spruiking it as halving media buyers' workloads because they can have one conversation with one sales team and reach 90% of Australia. He said something about how much bigger that makes them than 9 and 10 in terms of reach, and was really saying that, you know, despite the 9 and Fairfax merger, this makes Seven the biggest company and able to take on Facebook and YouTube.
Yes, there was that sort of talk of 90% population reach and this sort of thing. I mean, the timing of the announcement obviously was great because it just showed a bit of momentum ahead of the upfronts. You know, the PacMags deal gets debt down. This deal doesn't, you know, arguably helps the company's position on the ASX because, you know, as Henry says, it was a share-based deal. They're not spending money on it. So it all sort of shows this momentum. I guess maybe it also taps in a little bit to, we've seen a lot going on with the Boomtown initiative. This argument that regional audiences are being undervalued, and that the I'd love to get your perspective on it, Henry, that maybe there's a sort of reassessment of how much should be spent on metro versus regional when budgets are being allocated. So it feels like the timing was good for a number of reasons.
Well, I agree. The move is a smart move. It's a logical move. I think whilst the upfronts is really about content, Prime is a corporate announcement, and I think it was the right place to announce that. The mathematics on the proposed merger do point to one media organisation being able to provide 90% reach in Australia, so that is true. The market will need to sort of adjust to that proposition if it's to come to life, because the other two regional and metro pairings are not operating in that merged or centralised manner. So theoretically, what Kurt and James said about halving your workload could be the case on a third of the market opportunities. So if the whole market was to do that, then yes, that changes the way you engage. On the Boomtown comment, I think that's a really important and valid point. What I see as a huge opportunity is for the merger to drag regional investment back up by having the metro bigger brother insist that little brother gets fed properly as well. So I think there is definite opportunity there, and the whole regional sector will benefit from that. It may prompt a bit of curiosity from some of the other media groups to look at the remaining regional assets that exist. There has to be a consolidation. I think that's inevitable. Since the government's media reform and changes, we haven't seen the consolidation that we all expected. You know, what we saw was Nine make their play, and I think it's fair to say that Nine's move was a game changer for their business, and it put them in the lead position as a media organisation. So seeing Seven follow suit is a good sign for the broader sector. What this now means for other parts of the organisation, what does News do?
What do you think News will do?
Well, News is still one of the largest footprints in the Australian marketplace. And, you know, they are getting a lot smarter about how they make their footprint, you know, really felt in the marketplace. So, you know, I think in the next 12 months, you know, it's a leap year. We may see some leaps of faith. We may see more corporate activity. All of this points to a healthy, a vibrant marketplace. And, you know, I'm going to try and be a broken record for as long as I can. What it really highlights is how much opportunity there is for brands and for marketers to re-engage and re-evaluate how much they're using media, marketing and comms to drive their business. And I think that's, you know, an important sign.
Well, on that leap of faith, I think we're out of time. So in a big media week, Henry, thank you very much for joining us.
Pleasure.
Brittany, thank you.
Thanks, Tim.
Vivian, thank you.
You're welcome.
That's all for this week. Toodle-pip.